Because folks, committee members, I saw a problem with this. What we're attempting to do is allocate dollars from the tobacco settlement to these programs. We had another bill that set up a trust fund out of the tobacco settlement that was designed for some long-term program funding, and with the way we designed that settlement, it gets really hard to get at the principle. It takes a two-thirds vote, which makes it problematic because this is taking money out of the tobacco settlement. And so what we're going to have to do is get an amendment to this bill to where we're just dealing with spending dollars that are, okay, right now, what we have in the state is we have tobacco settlement dollars. They're sitting there, okay? And what we want to do with this bill is take some of those dollars that are sitting there and spend them on these programs. And the way this bill is structured, I don't think it allows us to do that. Because it sets up a trust fund, puts money in the trust fund, and we'll have conflict. Read the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what we want to do is just allocate money that we currently have to these programs. So we will amend the bill to make a direct allocation out of monies already received by the state of Oregon in a tobacco settlement for these programs.
May I?
Yes.
Well, I want to add something to this. When we call legislative counsel to draft this bill, we did not ask them to put in, it says establishes a tobacco settlement trust fund. They called us back and said they had to do this at some point, and we said fine. Not understanding the ramifications and what
fine.
The bill,
right.
The bill that Representative Cruz talked about yesterday will establish the trust fund, but his bill will allow money that is already sitting there to go to the purposes that we want it to go
right.
to.
So right.
That money is not in the trust fund. So what we're going to do is get an amendment to take out
Section 2.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair, there's no, the word trust doesn't appear in that, does it? I can't find it.
It's right there. Line 5.
Line 5, the Tobacco Settlement Fund. I don't see the word trust.
Trust, okay.
It's interest
and... You're right. That's semantics, but this is...
Yes.
Well, in subsection 2 says, monies in the Tobacco Settlement Fund are continuously appropriated to the Oregon Department of Administrative Service to be expended for purposes provided by a law. And then it goes on to define what those are. I don't think this sets up a trust.
But it's the interest.
It's, okay. What we have is we have monies that we are going to make direct budget allocations for. For us to take this money, send it over to the Department of Treasury, and bring it back makes absolutely no sense. This is for purposes of clarity as to the different sorts of structures we're trying to set up.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, I think it might be helpful to ask the Legislative Council whether this sets up a trust fund or not. It does not appear to me. The next sentence on beginning line 6, interest earned by the Tobacco Settlement Fund shall be credited to the fund. That doesn't say that the only interest money can be spent. The fund consists of, and then it lists those three items, and then it says the fund's appropriated. I don't think this is a trust fund.
I understand that, but we want to set, it is probably what's going to happen in this legislative session is that the majority of the dollars that we have received or will receive in this biennium are going to be allocated to specific programs.
Right.
One of the things we're attempting to do is reserve at least some of that money into a fund for some long-term program funding. So we only want to set up one fund here that's operating out of the Department of Treasury. The rest of the money is going to go to direct allocation.
Ah.
We want this to go to direct allocation.
So what you're saying is even if this isn't a trust fund, we still don't want this fund. We want it to go somewhere else. The funds in addition to,
right.
Other than what's being expended here.
The funding for these programs should be a direct allocation in the budget process rather than, it doesn't need to take this extra step of going to the Treasury and, you know,
And
I understand.
Another difference is that the fund that we spoke about yesterday requires two-thirds vote. to get money out of that.
That is a trust fund.
That is
right.
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 And I opposed that on the basis that it was hard to get the money out. This fund I like a lot because you don't have to do any of those things.
Well, Representative, if we get rid of Section 2, we don't have to even do even less, so...
Okay.
So with that, I will close the public hearing on 3951, and we'll bring it back with the amendment.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I apologize for not noticing that earlier, committee. And I'm going to open a public hearing on 2896. Diane?
Members of the committee, House Bill 2896 creates a prescription drug coverage task force. It specifies the membership and composition of the task force and requires the task force to take issues regarding cost of pharmaceutical drugs and access to prescription drugs for Oregon senior citizens. The task force is to report its findings to an interim committee of the 71st Legislative Assembly. It declares an emergency, but it has not declared an effective date, either on passage or July 1. And that would suffer, okay. I imagine, through an amendment.
Second one now.
And you'll notice, committee members, that this darn thing only has 60 House members signed on to it. So it may become controversial really quick.
How many votes do we need to pass this?
Are we calling?
Do we need to have a hearing?
Okay. Phyllis? Okay. Phyllis, do you want to come up?
You mean everybody signed on to this? She's persuasive.
Please, Phyllis.
Okay, thank you. Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Rand, Capital Coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2896. The Commission will, and in the near future, release the findings of a statewide drug cost survey. Although we do not have the final report to share with you right now, I want to share some of the findings that we discovered. Many seniors in Oregon have had to choose between eating, clothing, paying rent, or paying for their prescription drugs. 57% of the survey respondents have no insurance coverage for prescription drugs, and 50% stretch their medication by taking just partial doses of the prescribed amount. 83% skip filling prescriptions, and 22% travel to Canada or Mexico because they can get a substantial savings by going out of the country to get their prescription drugs. The state budget reality will not let us adopt any meaningful prescription drug program right now. But quite frankly, in 2001, we don't really have a handle on the extent to which high prescription drugs costs are affecting Oregon seniors. And even if we did, the general fund, if they were available in the next biennium, we really are lacking for the best strategies to expand access to and decrease costs of prescription drugs for seniors. So House Bill 2896 is a well-thought-out vehicle for gathering credible data and for forging an enduring consensus to tackle every real problem in 2003. House Bill 2896 is a good bill and should be recommended to the floor. Do pass. Thank you. And if you have any questions, I do have, we're waiting for the final results of our drug survey. And we did approximately 600 surveys that were returned to the commission. And actually, Dolores Hubert, who's sitting in the room, is chair of the Health and Long-Term Care Committee for the Governor's Commission, and it was her committee that did this drug survey. So I just wanted to recognize her for the hard work that she's done on this. Mm-hmm. And we'll get you the results as soon as they get here.
Thank you, Phyllis. Any questions? Representative Bonhart.
Yes, there's a blank in the bill, line 26 on page 2, that about what date this still takes effect.
We'll let Representative Carlson deal with that.
I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes, and maybe Representative Carlson will be able to answer this too. I know the Oregon Health Council Commission or Council, I forget. The one that today that where we added another person.
Yeah, I'm an expert on that one.
I know. Council. They are also addressing, they wanted to have a pharmacist come on board and that, and so they are addressing this very issue, and I want to make sure that there is no, that groups work together, and it would be nice to know what the Oregon Health Council's role is in this, because I'd hate to have two agencies working on two different tracks. So if this is passed, I think it should be important that they work very closely with the Oregon Health Council, because evidently they're working with technology or something regarding pharmacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Janet Carlson, District 32. I proposed this bill because as I was walking through my district, I was approached by senior citizens, not all of them in what you would consider poverty, many of them in middle-class average situations, who said they were paying $800 a month for their prescription drugs, $900 a month for their prescription drugs, and that was quite a burden. I also heard a story about a man who is in his 80s that went to work at McDonald's part-time so that he could earn enough money to cover his wife's prescription drug bill. So I think this is a big issue for seniors. I know it is for seniors in my district, and I'm sure many, if not all of you, have heard similar stories from your constituents. The other part in trying to think through the solution is, and this addresses partially Representative Mona Sanderson's question, is that it seems like we haven't ever had all the players at the table or at the same table at the same time. And so what I was hoping to do through this bill was provide a forum where the governor would appoint folks from the public sector, if you will, from the Director of Human Services or designee, the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and you just heard Phyllis Rand's testimony, two members of statewide advocacy organizations, and a licensed pharmacist organization. And then the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House would also select each five members from the more of the business sector, so the pharmaceutical manufacturers, the health insurance industry, the hospital and health systems, the physicians, legislators. And so that group together, having those different interests at the table, would come up with some solutions to this problem. The tasks of the task force would be to examine the problems in access and affordability for prescription drugs, including looking at what other states have done in this arena. The process that I used after pulling this together as a concept was I went with to each of the groups that were listed, and I did have a discussion with John Santa and with some other folks from the governor's office to let them know that I was interested in doing this. They expressed some interest in working with me on it. I talked with Tom Holt from the Pharmacists Association, and that's where that got added in. I talked with Phyllis, and she took a look at it from her perspective. Jackie Zimmer, who was here earlier today and told me that she had other hearings she had to go to, wanted to express her support. from the, let me look at the official name, Area Associations on Aging. So the advocacy group also thinks that this is a good idea. I'm hoping that there is not a large fiscal on it. We did not entitle the members of the task force to compensation. We did allow some reimbursement of actual and necessary travel and other expenses. I have no idea what that would be. It really probably would depend on how far people came from and how many times the group met. I didn't put in an effective date to answer Representative Barnhart's question because given what is going on at the national level with Medicare, I wasn't quite sure whether this group ought to meet immediately or whether it ought to wait until a decision got made. And so you can maybe give me some feedback on that issue, and we can talk about what you think on that. The other thing I wanted to point out, and I've saved my cover sheet, is that 59 other members signed on to this bill, including...
other members.
Right. Right, including everyone at this table, and I appreciate your willingness to consider it as a concept. And Representative Bates is here in support of the bill as well.
Yeah. Just for the committee's information, we will send this to Ways and Means for a couple reasons. Number one, so they can have conversations with Dave Henderson about the staffing issue and what's going to be appropriate, and see if it's within budget and or if another allocation needs to be made. And I guess my comment to Representative Carlson would be I would put a relatively soon effective date for this group to begin. They can sit down, do the organizational stuff, take a look at what's happening at the federal level, and as a group make a decision on a course of action. So,
and we could put an emergency clause in it for that.
Yeah. I would suggest that an emergency clause would be appropriate, so they could meet shortly after Sine die.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Representative Bates.
Chairman Cruz and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to speak today. For the record, I'm Alan Bates, State Representative of District 2, which is Ashland and Eagle Point area, and I'm a practicing physician. I promise you I'll not make it a habit to be here daily to bother you.
You're going to be here a lot more now than you were.
Twice in one day is probably all you can tolerate, and I appreciate your toleration. I particularly like this bill for several reasons. One, it's bipartisan. Representative Carlson and I seem to sit together all day long at various committees. And we're not joined at the hip yet, but I don't hope that'll never happen for this poor woman. Sitting next to me is bad enough. But this is something we both agree on, and the perspective that I bring to it is that I see these patients every day, as I told you earlier. The people in our society that are most at risk for prescription drug costs are senior citizens. It's a very fluid market right now, and there's no good answer out there. We've looked at Medicare, Medicaid programs to bring costs down for them. You heard about bulk purchasing earlier today. But there is no real answer out there right now to resolve the problem of people over 65 who have no health insurance coverage for prescription drugs. I think this is going to be an excellent vehicle to have the time to sit down and really look at this issue and decide what can and cannot be done on a reasonable and a fairly convenient basis. The other piece of this is that I believe, and many of us believe, that the federal government is going to act on this. How that money is made available for people and seniors is uncertain at this point, but it may well be a block grant. If that block grant were to come to the state, to have an organization like this ready and willing to deal with it, I think would be an excellent choice for this legislature to make. For that reason, and the reason of the terrible need out in the public for this, I strongly support this bill. Hope you will pass it, and we'll set this committee up to start meeting as quickly as possible after Sine die. I have a hunch that there's not too many representatives and senators who want to step into the breach and do it right now. But after we close down, I expect you to have plenty of volunteers to step forward and take care of this. I think it's a good bill. I think Representative Carlson has had some real foresight in putting it together, and she should be applauded for it.
Questions? Representative Lee.
Yeah, I was one of the people who signed on, and I didn't go into much detail in reading it before, but since I've read it more recently, I'm wondering if either of you or both of you might respond to my question. I'm wondering if down on lines 15 through 17, if we really need to have 10 people appointed by the Senate President and Speaker, or if we could just have them jointly select 4 persons plus 2 legislators, since it would need to be bipartisan, with perhaps one from each party or maybe 2 from different regions. So that if we have then a task force of 11 or 12, then we would have a little less financial impact. And if we were to give travel expenses, hopefully it would only be to the private citizens and not to the legislators and staff people, to try to cut the fiscal impact a little. So I'd be interested in hearing if you think that would deter from what's presented.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, being a member of the House, I think it would be appropriate that we had 4 from the House and 2 from the Senate, of course. It seems a reasonable thing to me if you want to start cutting this thing down.
Becomes problematic.
Yes, I'm sorry. Okay.
1 Senator and 1 House.
Well, if I could answer, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I think, frankly, cutting it from 16 people to 12 people probably wouldn't make much difference here or there in terms of the fiscal impact. I don't think the fiscal impact is going to be that large as it is. The staffing costs would remain the same. That's the lion's share of the cost. The travel reimbursement, depending on how far people came from, many of these people are in the Portland or Salem area from these associations. Because the pharmaceutical industry is not monolithic, nor is the health insurance industry, nor are the hospital and health systems, I think having a couple representatives would make, it was my belief, it would make it feel more inclusive. And I think that what we've had up to this point have been some industry representatives together, some government representatives, and some mixture. But as I said before, we haven't had the full-blown group together in the same room, and I think this gives us the opportunity to find out where we have common ground and to be able to move forward.
And I guess I would also add that many members increases our ability to have a bipartisan support of the finished product. So I think it's a good number. Representative Barnhart.
I might just note that we've heard about other commissions containing industry members of various sorts, and that they tend not to file for reimbursement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Just
yes,
a follow-up, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Representative Bates, that you could maybe answer this question. What is the Health Council? Is there a focus on prescription?
Health resources?
The Oregon Health Council.
There's 3 groups out there, Health Resources, Health Service Commission, and Health Council, and they have some overlapping issues. The Health Council is probably more of a wide-open group as far as what they deal with. I haven't seen any of their issues in the last, probably a year. So I haven't followed for you, so I probably can't answer that very well for you.
It would be nice, though, whatever comes out of this, that those other health-related commissions be sent minutes or kept apprised of what we're doing.
I would point out that OMAP is intimately involved in all of these other things.
Yes.
So there's cross-pollinization here already.
The Oregon Health and Policy Research would be bringing the commission and the services council
board.
Because you'll have similar members. That's where the commission and the resources, health resources commission and the health services council rest.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for bringing us such a controversial piece of legislation.
We have a short hearing.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2896, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2896. Colleagues, it does not have a referral to Ways and Means, but I think that's the appropriate place to send it, to have, rather than to have them fill in that blank at the end, which is appropriate, and also to add an emergency clause, which is also appropriate for the Ways and Means Committee to do. And interestingly enough, those 2 folks that just testified will be on the subcommittee this goes to. So,
stacking the deck.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2896 be sent to the Ways and Means Committee with a 2-pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 2896 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a 2-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
See, I got your name right.
Representative Gerard.
Aye.
Representative Montana.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2896, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2896. And we're going to jump ahead here, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3448. Diane.
What?
Chairperson and members of the committee, House Bill 3448 exempts from licensing requirements nurses who perform outside Oregon that is incidental to distance learning programs of institutions of higher education in Oregon. This is a bill that basically cleans up some statute and some difficulties for nursing people studying nursing through distance learning outside of Oregon.
Makes sense to me.
Do you have a motion on
the floor? Yeah, I'll move. Well, let's get some testimony, and then we'll pass the bell.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We could. We're doing fine, though. Please, go ahead. Identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Representative Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Catherine Salveson. I'm on the faculty at the School of Nursing at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland. We're here in support of the House Bill 3448, and specifically we're speaking to nurses who are coming into Oregon in order to advance their education. The current language of this statute requires nurses who live and practice in areas outside Oregon to obtain a temporary limited Oregon nursing license before they can take any education courses from an Oregon university. These are nurses who are licensed to practice in the state they live in and who are not actively practicing nursing in Oregon. They only wish to attend school here. There's a $50 cost involved, a significant amount of time that's lost in securing this necessary limited license, and truly no real benefit associated with this requirement. The OHSU School of Nursing delivers its academic programs to nurses throughout the state of Oregon and beyond our borders. For example, many nurses in our regional area choose to attend our campuses in Ashland, Klamath Falls, and LeGrand, as well as in Portland. Nurses living in our border states see this requirement as a real disincentive to advance their nursing education in Oregon schools. And it's sending a message that nurses are not welcome from outside Oregon. This is not helpful at a time when we in Oregon are actively recruiting to fill serious nursing shortages, particularly in our rural areas. Attending one of our campuses often provides the experience that encourages nurses to decide to ultimately move and practice in Oregon, and at that time they obtain the required full Oregon license to practice. There is no support for the continuation of this old statute. Louise Shores from the Oregon State Board of Nursing supports this amendment, and speaking for the board states that we support this amendment in full and see no protection of the public issues. So we encourage your support for this change, and we would be open to any questions you might have.
Do you want to add anything?
I have nothing to add, and I'm Marna Flaherty Robb, Director of Practice, and I'm fully in support of this change in language, and all of our colleagues and the Board of Nursing is as well. So we hope that you will support it.
Any questions, committee? This is
easy.
A pretty easy one.
Yes, right.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close public hearing on 3448 and open a work session on House Bill 3448.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3448 to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Morissette moves House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei? Aye.
Representative Cummel?
Aye.
Representative
Morrison? Aye.
Representative
Gerard?
Aye.
Representative
Montana?
Aye.
Representative
Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 3448, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Morissette has requested carrying, so he will carry. He likes to speak on the floor.
Well, I was going to suggest this might go on the consent agenda.
But he would vote no on that, so there's no point going there.
Okay.
So I will close the work session on 3448. Thank you very much for coming. So they want to do it now? Okay. Colleagues, damn, we're doing so well. I want to ask the committee a question first of all. At this point, when I decided we were going to go longer, I made the decision based on the way everybody would get dragging about this time of going continuous, that it would be good to do dinner breaks and then come back. Do you like that idea, or would you just soon slug on through?
Well, it depends on the agenda, Mr. Chair. If the agenda is one that we just absolutely can't get through, then I would say we should take a dinner break. But if it's if you've got, this isn't quite like another committee that I'm on that, you know, has 14 different agenda items.
We could do that.
I know we could, but I don't feel compelled.
And the questions that
we care to identify that.
Okay.
Saying as long as I'm not here asking questions.
Yeah, that's right.
If we do need to take it in a break, because at some evening, I would prefer to take it later than 4:30, so that it gives us a better chance of actually getting through the agenda then too.
Yeah, Representative.
It would be nice to just schedule it, and then if we're going really long, you know, take a 20-minute or a half-hour recess, and then come back.
Okay. I was trying to be sensitive to wearing you out too much with huge blocks of stuff. So,
well, considering that we started
so much bigger than they ended up being. So.
Well, yeah, we ended up cutting some bills, but
considering that we started at 1:30 versus 3:30 or 3:15, I think makes a difference too.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're kind of stuck for tonight because we got some folks that are on the next bill that were coming in based on this schedule. So, but I will adjust future schedules, and we'll just try to run blocks and if we need to stand at ease for a few minutes just to breathe fresh air, we can do that sort of thing.
Well, aren't we scheduled for HJM 31 before 4:30?
We did that first.
Oh,
already done.
I was late.
We set it to rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would still be here.
Oh, yes.
It's rules or judiciary? Yeah.
We set it to rules. The chair of that committee was asking for it in the rules.
And judiciary was not going to schedule any new bills, as I understood.
We're not.
How do we have
one? Yes. And since Representative Wilson asked for it, I said, absolutely, sir, you may have it. So, what we've got is the book. The one that Representative Schrader and Representative Bates spoke to earlier, because they had to go to something else. But we've got folks that are coming in later to testify.
Oh,
I have calls today.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Are these people here to testify?
We have a couple people that would like to testify now on it, so I'm going to take that testimony.
Okay, before I knew that we had a night session, I had plans to be somewhere at 5:30 tonight, and I think some others here did.
Well, and
so if we can do that, it would be great.
And folks, that's fine as long as some of you come back, because we're not moving the bill today. The bill needs amendments. We know that. So, but I did want to accommodate all those that wanted to come in, that had scheduled to come in later to testify. So with that, I will reopen the public hearing on 3027. Tom Holt.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Tom, would you begin your testimony with "in summary"? Right there.
I will be brief.
We really do like you.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I do appreciate the courtesy of being called up, since it's going to allow me to get to a meeting this evening with my kids'
too,
school. So we have some serious concerns about House Bill 3027, and I understand that the bill we see may not be the bill we end up with. But I will speak to some of the elements of the bill and some of the testimony that was earlier today. At least as written, what this would set in motion is the state really having the authority to become the purchaser of prescription drugs in the state of Oregon. The very idea of that raises in our minds huge complexities of how that would actually work in practice. Just a few examples of where this is problematic. There's a mixture in the bill of purchasing on behalf of state employees, Medicaid, the uninsured, potentially people already under private plans. As worded anyway, there is really no limitation on who would ultimately be able to be in this plan, although it says that it would be that there would be, for example, residents of Oregon with limited or no insurance coverage for prescription drugs. Well, all health plans have some ultimate limit on their coverage, so that potential is there. But the really larger issue here from our perspective is the disruption that this potentially could cause in the distribution system of pharmaceuticals and our members' ability to get best wholesale prices for the patients that they serve. Prescription drug pricing does not work like almost any other good I've ever seen. It is not, in all respect to the earlier testimony, a matter of gathering together a larger volume and doing, you know, sort of like Walmart does for fishing poles or something, where they buy by the boxcar and therefore get a better price. Pharmaceutical pricing is primarily by class of trade. There are, and perhaps Mr. Gardner could speak to this in more detail, but what I can tell you in summary is that the prices that a retail pharmacy pays are different from a price that a hospital will pay, which are different from what a mail order will pay, and are different from even than what a nursing home might pay. They fall under different classes of trade. And are grouped together differently in pharmacy contracts. And what happens in practical terms is that pharmacies group together either as large purchasers themselves within their class of trade to get a good deal. But when you start pulling out large groups of their customers, it would inhibit their ability to get that best price, and what you would create is actually, rather than a savings, a cost shift to other elements of the market. It's an extraordinarily complex business, which if I ever begin to understand it, I will be a very rich man. But it's an area fraught with complexities. There are a number of issues involved in terms of just the distribution. There's even reference in the bill and in the testimony earlier that perhaps the state could get into the distribution business. I can't imagine the state really wanting to do that. It's not only a business where the big players don't really do very well financially, but they're consolidating because they're trying to survive. And it's hard to imagine that succeeding. Ultimately, somebody has to provide service, and it's more than just distribution that wholesalers provide to pharmacies. They also provide a lot of systems support in terms of processing systems and marketing and everything you can imagine connected with pharmacy business. Our wholesaler suppliers are somehow involved in. And the actual shipping of drugs from point A to point B is only a small part of what takes place in that process. And this type of a system contemplated in the bill would potentially disrupt that. Another point I would like to make in terms of the grouping of the patients together ultimately or individuals is that there'd be potentially some interference with public employee contracts, and that they have some of them have some very specific needs in terms of their prescription benefits. And I'm not sure how this would fit into that program. I just raise that as a question. I'd also like to just dwell for a moment on the sentiment that was expressed that this could create a mechanism to send a lot of things to mail order. We have mail order members. And I want to be clear that we don't have any. I'm not here to speak against mail order. However, mail order in the marketplace now is something that, generally speaking, people are allowed to select voluntarily. Some health plans, I would add, have extraordinarily discriminatory copays that really push people into mail order. Pushing people or grouping people into mail order arbitrarily because they happen to be a state employee or because they happen to have a current condition is extremely inappropriate for a number of reasons. Mail order works when people affirmatively select it, and they've already made something of a decision that they want to deal with that issue. But when you do that, when people don't really want to be there, some of the results you get are fragmentation of the medication record, which results in more drug-drug interactions where a community pharmacy is not aware of things that a person may be getting from a mail order. In fact, there was a fatal interaction for that very reason about a year ago in Oregon. So it can be quite a serious thing. And the other element there in turn is that many pharmacies are providing services to people who have chronic conditions such as asthma and diabetes and so on, people who are on medications for a long period of time. And they cannot get those services the same way from a mail order pharmacy that they can get them from a community pharmacy. And I think if I had some mail order pharmacy people here with me today, they would basically say the same thing, that my mail order pharmacist would say, we don't want the people who don't want to be with our service, and we don't really want the people who really require sitting down with a pharmacist face to face and to look at an asthma inhaler and learn how it works. A little while ago, on a different bill, Mike Canton, pharmacist in Sacred Heart, explained to you all how it takes about 20 minutes or so to really sit down and show someone all the steps of using an inhaler, and that all those steps have to be done in a certain way, and you simply can't do that through a mail order process. So while we're sympathetic to the desire to find savings in the prescription drug system and in the distribution of drugs, certainly our members would like to help in that process. We have a number of other vehicles in this building looking at ways to better manage prescription drugs. You'll be hearing a bill later on dealing with case management and Medicaid. Over on the Senate side, we're looking at a number of different things. Representative Walker has a bill dealing with primary care pharmacy selection, a number of things that we think would be much more productive than going down this road, which causes us great concern about creating cost shifts, and disruption, and ultimately diminution of potentially of patient care that would not serve the interest that all of us here want to advance. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and thank you again for allowing me to be up on the clock earlier than planned.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would your association be open to, obviously you'll probably be a part of the work group because they say this isn't the final product, but I'm taking a look at women's drugs in particular, like birth control pills and estrogen after menopause in particular. At least in the public health arena, there's always a trial period of a woman making sure it's the right pill, et cetera, and then we actually give them 6 months' supply of birth control pills, and then they come back to always check in for signs and symptoms, and then we give them another 6 pills. But there's always that first 3 months in which it's wanting to make sure it works out. That's one. And then estrogen, too. I mean, and then we have the vaccine program in which actually the state buys free vaccine and then distributes it to, of course, county health departments, but then physicians who want to participate. There's some paperwork involved, but they actually get a free vaccine. Do you think your association would be open to those kinds of possibilities?
Chair Cruz, Representative Miles Anderson, if I understand the question, would we be open to looking at particular classes of...
Where your pharmacists actually could be part of being able to purchase at very low cost some of these drugs and through the state. I mean, I don't know if that's the way we should go, and I'm not saying I'm for or against the bill for that matter, but...
I think, Chair Cruz, Representative Miles Anderson, I think I could say categorically that my members would always like to get a better price.
That's right. Okay. All right. That's just what I needed to hear.
Representative Morris,
Tom, would your association rather have this bill or a bill patterned after the one in the state of Maine?
Chair Cruz, Representative Morissette, I think that's what's termed the devil's alternative. Neither. The state of Maine program, I should say, resulted in one, I believe there's still ongoing litigation, but also wholesalers were unable to acquire or stop servicing certain areas of that state or the state entirely. I'm not clear on all the details. So obviously I'm more focused on what happens here in Oregon, but what I heard was that some things became unavailable through Maine and it really didn't work.
I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but I guess that what happened in the state of Maine came about because of a lot of frustration by people who felt that the drug costs were too high. And so I guess what I was getting at is I think we need to work on something, and then this work group come up with something that is satisfactory to a lot of, you know, I mean, we've got to find some way to bring down the cost of drugs before someone advocates an extreme measure like they did in the state of Maine, which I don't think is, I would not like that either, but I just think we need to do something.
Yeah, people in this state advocating extreme measures. Representative Girard.
Well, sir.
Tom, I'd like to have your interpretation of under Section 2, Line 31. It says, upon request, the department may include other governmental entities in the prescription drug bulk purchasing program. What is your interpretation of that line?
Chair Cruz, Representative Girard, on the face of it, that would appear to be a fairly wide open way for any governmental body in Oregon, perhaps outside of Oregon, to participate in the program.
Follow? Yeah, it says other governmental entities, which would indicate to me that anything that was considered to be a governmental entity could therefore qualify under that line.
I believe that would be correct.
You interpret it the same way?
On the face of it, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Just keep in mind, committee, I told you not to be too married to the language of the bill.
Mm-hmm. We're just pointing out areas we want you to marry.
to look out on? Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate all the input. Any other questions? Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Jim?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and I'm going to also not sort of marry my testimony to the bill, but just to give you an alert to a couple of issues that are here, I think, implicit in this bill. There's really, I think, three sets of policy issues implicit in this legislation. The first is, should the state try to be as prudent a purchaser as possible with regard to its state agency purchases for agencies like corrections, mental health division, And I would include within that subdivisions of state government, cities, counties, school districts, et cetera. That's policy issue number one. And I think that clearly if the state feels that it can become a more prudent purchaser by aggregating demand from those agencies and improving its bargaining position, that's something if I were a rational state purchaser, I would do. The fact is that several agencies now, and I'm not sure, Hirsch Crawford would really know the details on this, are now part of the 37-state Minnesota Purchasing Cooperative. Why more of them are not, I don't know. So I think some local governments in the state of Oregon, some but not all, are part of that 37-state consortium. And that, of course, if you aggregate, there you're aggregating demand not only from the state of Oregon, but you're doing it with a large multi-state purchasing group. Some other entities, I believe, some specialized healthcare entities utilize Premier, which is another private sector aggregating entity for whatever reason. They may have specialized services that are better tailored to the needs of that group. So it certainly is something that I'm not even sure you need legislation to do that, frankly. I think that's something that DAS could do or DHR could work with DAS to do. But if that certainly would be a prudent course. There's a separate issue as to OMAP and Medicaid. And I think, Chairman Cruz, you and I were at the meeting the other night where Hirsch Crawford indicated that they had actually approached the Minnesota Consortium with regard to OMAP purchases, presumably for fee-for-service drugs, and they were told they were not eligible to participate because of legal constraints. And I'm certainly not an expert in what those are, but I suspect that there may be two sets of considerations. There is the federal best price law, which now is in effect and which was the basis for the injunction in the state of Maine, where you bring together your OMAP purchases, which are already guaranteed best price under federal law, and you bring those into a purchasing pool with other state agency purchases, there's some kind of a legal impediment to that. Hirsch Crawford, again, would be the one, because they actually tried to do it and they were told they couldn't.
Well, I think part of it with that consortium, it's got to be a self-contained system. So you also have the ability to dispense. So that's what kind of takes it down to state hospital, DOC, things like that.
It was that kind of thing. And he said it was like an antitrust issue, which I couldn't quite figure out why that would be. But there is an issue there that there is some kind of a, and I've been told that there may be some problems under the federal law that mandates best price for Medicaid. The third issue, so that's an issue to explore. That adds a level of complexity to it if you actually bring in not only the state agencies other than those providing Medicaid services, the Medicaid agencies. The third level of issues, I think, was very well covered by Tom. There's a whole set of policy issues when you extend this into the private or commercial sector that don't arise when the state is simply trying to be a prudent purchaser as to its own needs. So I think all of those need careful and really distinct policy analysis, and it may be that you can do, say, one of them soon, and the rest of them you study in this study task force you've just created.
Questions? Thank you. We'll continue meeting in the task force.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. John Santa. These people that monitor the committee and find out that they may get in early,
Yeah, great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Sant, Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. Actually, I ran over because I thought you were having the hearing, and only to hear you're going to be here at 6. I love prescription drugs. I'm actually testifying today on behalf of DAS. which our agency actually is under DAS. While we're a policy agency, we're under DAS. Our position on this bill is that we're neutral, but we think it represents an opportunity for an interesting discussion. We think the issue or problem in some respects that the bill addresses that gives us an opportunity is the lack of both infrastructure and staff in state government whose sole purpose is to negotiate discounted prices on the purchase of prescription drugs. We think there's an opportunity to at least have a discussion about the pros and cons of that kind of expertise being more a part of state government. For the state, the cost of prescription drugs has become significant. They're increasingly as costly as many other major health services provided to Oregonians. In fact, the increase in the cost of prescription drugs is among the largest increases in the governor's recommended budget. The state has dedicated resources to define options around the selection of drugs, including formularies. We won't go to formularies, but we're fine there. We can get very expert help, both within state government and outside of state government, to help us in those issues. We're also fine in terms of evaluating benefits, including benefits around prescription drugs. I mean, I'm on the board of PEB, and when it comes to workers' comp, there's a lot of expertise around benefits. The purchasing of prescription drugs is what we're talking about today, and that's a very complex process in a very competitive market, and it's usually managed by individuals with specific expertise in those matters. And we think 3027, there should at least be some consideration bringing that kind of expertise into the state. Our current situation is I've attached a survey of drug purchasing among state agencies. And you'll see that the big purchasers are really benefit purchasers, OMAP and PEB and PERS and Workers' Comp and OMIP. Mm-hmm. And then you see the agencies that are directly purchasing, corrections, the health division, the hospital, the youth authority, the university. And now if you add up these numbers, you see that we're going to get pretty close to spending $1 billion on prescription drugs in the next biennium. And if you include federal funds, we're going to be pretty close to $2 billion. Most of the state spending on prescription drugs occur through prescription drug benefit programs. And Jim, I think, was clarifying some of that. However, several agencies do directly purchase. These state and public agencies do combine their drug purchasing through a drug buying consortium, the Minnesota plan. Now, it's interesting, actually, that when we surveyed these agencies, the state hospital has recently switched to Premier. Premier is a large national concern that mostly buys for hospitals. Now, so the question comes up, who's got the better deal, Minnesota or Premier?
Depends on the day of the week.
You got to know what you're doing to figure out who's given the state the best deal. And even could Premier do some of the more outpatient-oriented things that Minnesota does? And the state hospital feels they're getting a better deal from Premier than they got from Minnesota. So I just want to give you a sense that those issues are out there. And this is a very difficult area to evaluate. Now, we're using several vendors, and actually there's some state agencies. I think the Youth Authority, for example, purchases from some pharmacies close to them because they need a very specific kind of buying strategy. I think they need individually packaged drugs, so they might not fit into a strategy at all. But frankly, you know, you got to have somebody familiar with it to go out there and look at all of these and figure out, well, who could work through what kind of arrangement and who couldn't. It's possible that some savings could be achieved through this sort of process that we're not getting now. So that there would at least be, we think, some potential payback of some in-house expertise. At best, probably it'd be a wash. The fiscal impact statement that we did, kind of that analysis, the best it would probably be is a wash. I mean, if Premier could be used where Minnesota is used now, and it's actually true that the Premier deal is better, and it's the quantity of improvement is what a state hospital thinks, it'd be about a wash. It'd just finance a purchasing team. There are three elements to successful purchasing. Strategies that help to combine purchasing power, but that alone doesn't mean that you're more successful. You do need to have agreement among purchasers who are combined about specific drugs to be purchased. That's what a formulary is. And you need then a communication system between physicians, pharmacists, and patients regarding which drugs are preferred. Actually, these agencies that directly purchase now are able to do that. You know, if you'll pardon the expression, corrections does have a captive population and a captive set of physicians. So, see, they can do that, and so can the other agencies. So it's possible that some increased coordination would be productive. Now, there are some other strategies available to the folks who purchase benefits. Each of the agencies purchasing benefits has advantages and disadvantages from a purchasing point of view. They each have unique circumstances that influence their purchasing decisions. And PEB has very capable consultants. OMAP has a federal arrangement, but there's always questions about, well, under some set of circumstances, would it be possible for OMAP to pursue some other purchasing strategy? A small purchasing team could provide the needed advice to agencies regarding their unique circumstances, identify some common strategies that might improve purchasing. In any business that purchases hundreds of millions of dollars of one product, I think would devote some resources to development of a comprehensive approach to the purchasing of that product. And we just felt, Bass felt that this bill was an opportunity to talk about that, and that's why I came. Thank you.
John, let's say, for example, we don't solve everything at first shot, but let's say, for example, that when we look at bulk purchasing, we were going to look at OHP chronic population, and we were going to outsource. You know, because there are some private companies that are very, very good at this sort of thing, which is one of the things we've been looking at. Is let's get a defined population, because our people that have basically the same drugs and they take them off for long periods of time, this would certainly be an area to begin looking at how this model works. Have you taken a look at that particular scenario?
Mm-hmm. I think there's some potential there.
Okay.
There's, I think, a number of potential folks who you could make compete for that kind of business. You would need a sharp purchaser on your side to make them compete and make them compete as hard as they possibly would compete, and then help you to choose which one is really giving you the best deal. Because what a person who doesn't know much about this and has learned something the last year is this is a complex purchasing process with rebates, discounts, holdbacks, grants, all kinds of stuff. And especially when you're talking potentially about the kinds of volumes that would be there, and given its own map, and there's the option of a very good price and rebate.
Mm-hmm.
So
So you don't want to lose that. You don't want to do any deal that would not be significantly better than that. You need somebody really, you need somebody tough on your side.
Well, of course, there's debates as whether the 15-1 happens all the time or just happens. I mean,
Yeah, and I'm not going to get into it this week. There's some investigations about some companies that allegedly haven't been playing by the rules in terms of the 15.1.
Right, right. So, I mean, that's one of the areas we're kind of looking at as we dip our toes into this water. That this may be a reasonable place to begin. So that's end of water.
Thank you, Chair Cruz. What I see, and I know this bill is going to be worked over, and you said don't be married to it, but I just wanted to point out for the record that when we look at this, that they would provide prescription drugs to the following group. Basically, the way this would be, you could almost cover anyone. I mean, and the problem with that is that the state would become a supplier of drugs and put everyone else out of business.
Right.
And because it's talking about these people or others who receive health services, employees benefit board. Any other individuals on behalf who the state purchase provides funds and subsidies, et cetera. Residents of Oregon with limited or no insurance coverage. Next thing you know, employers just wouldn't provide the coverage anymore and everybody could go to the state. I mean, that's... and then upon request, the department may include other government entities. Government entities could be anything that is considered a government entity, which is very loose under the law, which is counties, water districts, sewer districts, education districts. And we would end up with nearly everybody under this, which would be very devastating to the industry as a whole. So those people who are left on the outside would be paying a disproportionate cost of the system. So I think we need to be very careful. When first hearing about this bill, I thought this was to cover those individuals who would be part of institutions who had no other choice, or individuals who perhaps were, over a certain age, the elderly population or having troubles. I didn't think this would be a competitive type situation where the state would be competing with private industry to provide these same kinds of services. And that's one of the real pitfalls I see in this bill, the way it's written.
But, Representative, isn't it wonderful that this bill has so much flexibility that we can go anywhere we want with it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Away.
Dr. Santa, you mentioned in your materials that Minnesota buys their drugs in bulk through this kind of a process, right? Can you tell us more about that? Do they buy it for all the citizens, for a specific group of citizens? Is it for all residents, or is it for employees of the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, my impression is Minnesota organizes this purchasing consortium. It is focused on state and government agencies and agencies like ours that are able to distribute those drugs, usually have physicians who are serving their agencies, have very specific needs. My impression is Minnesota purchases about $550 million of drugs a year. That's actually not that big.
Mm-hmm.
As you can see from the survey. So my guess is they're serving the agencies like ours in 37 different states. They're mostly providing outpatient drugs, as far as I know, rather than inpatient drugs. They serve that government outpatient market. I'm sure, like Mr. Gardner says, that one of the reasons they've been able to organize this is because they have agreed to not let the drugs they purchase enter, especially the retail market, in other markets. The pharmaceutical companies are more willing to deal with them if it's clear which markets they're serving.
Mm-hmm.
Premier, for example, I've talked with them a lot just to try and get to know how they do business. They are restricted to hospitals. They could potentially look at some state agencies, but they would definitely have very strong prohibitions around any of their drugs finding their way into mail order pharmacies, retail pharmacies, repackaging arrangements. They would not work with anything that had that kind of prospect.
Sure. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. I'm just curious. Dr. Santa, I was just looking over the second page of your testimony, the Oregon's estimated prescription drug purchases. And I'm just curious, on the universities that are listed, are those, in fact, for medications through their student health services and then are actually resold to the students? Or are those medications that are purchased through other departments and then supplied for gratis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I assume that those were their student health services and that they were not selling those. Those are probably things like some vaccines, some medications that they probably give to students at the time when they're seeing of a variety of different sorts, some antibiotics, things of that sort.
If I may, Mr. Chair, the reason why I ask, I used to work at Western Oregon University, and part of my duties were included in the Student Health Center. And I know that there was a charge to the students for the medications that they got through us. As well, there was also many times that medications were prescribed and the students went to the drugstore in downtown Monmouth or somewhere here in Salem or wherever and got the medications themselves. But that's why I was asking about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think may know more than I do about in what circumstances they're allowed to charge students. I would bet that they do that in some way that clearly makes everyone comfortable they're not a retail pharmacy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. John. Thank you.
I don't know, are we?
You're going to be back at 6? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. If, Lynn?
I wish I could tell you. Well, I mean, I can substitute an hour. I can come back at 6.
There are people coming at 6.
I know there are at least a couple of people coming at 6. How many? I don't know.
Okay.
I wish I could tell you.
Why don't we recess for a little bit and give us a chance to... Okay. Go out and see where all this good food came from, and then again, we'll call it, be back a little before 6, and we'll start as early as we can. So, thank you. I know you will.